My problem with V for Vendetta is, you know, a comic book nerd here, right? So the book is
excellent. Well, then you don't like it.
And the film kind of, it's not bad, don't get me wrong, but it falls down at not only being great entertainment, but also getting the message across quite as well, I thought, which is a bit
disappointing. The book is better. Look at me. I read books.
It is all right. I admit the last time
it's not a comic.
I admit you haven't cracked a book since Tom Clancy died, but that's not the point. This is Bad Voltage Season 2, Show 3, and
yes,
as we have promised, we have a special guest here with, I'm Stuart Langridge, here with me, John O'Bacon, Jeremy Garcia. We have, from Gizmodo, friend of the show, Christina Warren. Hello, Christina.
Hey, guys.
Hi, Christina.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you back.
Yeah,
it's great to be back.
You were a huge hit after the last show. Everyone in our community loved it. We had a great time. So we're stoked that you can be here for a whole show. So thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. No, I was thinking back. I've, you know, been on a lot of podcasts. Honestly, like legit, you guys is one of my favorites. So I'm so glad to be back on your second season.
Since you,
you're either happy or a liar. One of the two.
since it's been a couple of years since you graced these hallowed halls, you've changed jobs since then. I do believe
I have changed jobs.
Can you tell us what you're doing now?
Sure. So I'm a senior reporter at Gizmodo. So I'm actually doing very similar things to what I did at Mashable. I write about technology. I review products. You know, I opine on different stuff. Work on long form features, that sort of thing.
Very cool.
Excellent.
Very cool.
So what do we have in this show, Jeremy?
So one of the things we're going to discuss is what really needs to happen to have a viable third-party mobile option, and if it even really is possible, and with a little extra kicker of where do we think computing is going.
There, we're also going to talk, obviously, Christina, her Twitter handle is Filmgirls, quite into movies, as you will discover later on. We're going to have a Bad Voltage film review, where each of us are going to pick three movies, the good, movies that we think are amazing, the bad, movies that we think are, well, most people think are bad, but we think are quite cool, and then the ugly, like genuinely terrible, terrible movies that maybe were directed by Christopher Nolan at one point in his history. You got to stick around for this. It's going to be fun.
And Mr. Garcia has purchased a box which brews beer for him. It's called the Pico Brew, and he's going to tell us all about it.
And now, Bad Voltage.
All right, so let's get in with the news. Christina, do you want to kick us off as you're our special guest on the show today?
Sure. So the FCC fined Vizio $2.2 million in the state of New Jersey because their smart TVs were spying on people. And this was a story that actually came up, I guess, in 2015. It was revealed that the Vizio smart TVs, without even like letting you know it was happening or have an opportunity to opt out, you could go into the settings and turn it off, but it was just happening by default. They were basically recording everything that you were watching, whether it was like Netflix or Hulu or Amazon or TV content, you know, if you had your cable box connected, and then they were collecting that along with your IP address to sell to advertisers.
Ah, that sounds nice.
I'm very glad you picked this one because I didn't pick it knowing that someone else would. So if someone didn't, I was going to be...
I'm so glad. So I wanted to kind of get you guys' take. I mean, $2.2 million in penalties is certainly not small, but it's also not a lot of money when you consider... That,
So what they were actually doing too is on a second by second basis, they were collecting a selection of pixels on the screen and then matching it to a database they had. So they knew exactly what you were watching, when you paused it, how much you watched of everything. They said they were capturing roughly 100 billion data points a day.
Jesus.
And then selling it. And then they said, well, it wasn't identifiable because we didn't give your name. We just gave your IP address. So $2.2 million actually seems low. But
I mean, to be clear, $2.2 million is a small amount of money is, you know, it's a large amount of money if you're the Bad Voltage Carl's Jr. donation fund, but it's nothing if you make televisions, for God's sake. That's about 15 seconds profits.
I also don't know if I want Vizio to know that the viewing habits of this household are Say Yes to the Dress, Rescue Bots, and Dexter, right? This sends very different messages
totally.
Out to the
world. Well, not only that, but I mean, there have been, at least in the United States, there have been rules, I think, dating back all the way to the Bork Supreme Court nominations, where the Supreme Court nominee, he did not get the nomination, was his, like, blockbuster, like his rental history was used in the confirmation process. And so there's like legal precedent where these companies are not supposed to be able to collect this sort of information. Like Netflix actually lobbied and had the law changed so that some of their information could be shared to social networks like Facebook and things like that. You could like openly opt to share those things. But there have been historically very clear laws about the fact that you're not supposed to track all this way. Like this isn't supposed to be allowed. Yeah.
The thing which is becoming very clear, though, is that, yeah, in theory, there are laws stopping you from doing this, but the penalties are so weak and enforcement is so low that there's really no motive to not do this. I mean, I don't know how much money they'd have made by selling this data to advertisers, but if it hasn't paid that $2.2 million fine already, then they're clearly doing it wrong. So what's to stop them doing it again tomorrow? One of their rivals do it again tomorrow? You hang out with people in the ad tech industry, and there's so much discussion and effort trying to find ways kind of around the rules. It's just such a dreadful environment. My first mistake was hanging
out. Your first mistake is hanging out with people in the ad tech industry. You know what the punishment for this is? Vizio being forced to make TVs that aren't crap. Okay, that's in my mind. So anyway,
Of the interesting things too, I think, is that they not only did it with new TVs, they upped over the air updated old TVs going back as far as the one sold in 2010 to do this. So that makes me even more nervous. Yeah.
Hang on, they took a thing which didn't do this and then just reached out and turned it into a bug in my house.
Yeah.
Correct.
Who are they? The frigging KGB? You're not supposed to be able to do that sort of thing.
No, you are not.
Wow. Also, TVs in 2010, like being able to report stuff back, was that a thing? Like a Vizio TV? Vizio TVs only got screens in 2015, didn't they? I don't know. I'm not a fan of Vizio TVs, as you can probably tell. Anyway,
difficult to tell.
So, Jeremy, what have you got for us?
So, mine is kind of also a privacy-related one, and it's data on a man's pacemaker led to his arrest on arson charges. And this happened in Middleton, Ohio. A man was charged with aggravated arson and insurance fraud after data from his pacemaker was inconsistent with his claims about his physical activity when his house burned to the ground. And they did end up charging him. This ended up being the thing that really got him to, you know, be found guilty. And it's interesting. Not only that, it's a little bit scary that your pacemaker can be used against you, but the EFF came out and their staff lawyer actually said, Americans shouldn't have to make a choice between health and privacy. We as a society value our right to maintain privacy over personal and medical information, and compelling citizens to turn over protected health data to law enforcement erodes those rights. So people now do actually have to make a decision. Do I want to have a pacemaker and not die, or do I want to be tracked in a way that can be used against me? Not that you should be burning your house down, obviously, but...
To be clear here, right, not a lawyer, but how is forcibly making someone give you the data from their pacemaker not a violation of the law against self-incrimination?
Right.
They got a warrant, and I think the way... You would think, but I think because it's technically third-party data... Because the pacemaker is not you, it would be my guess on how they finagled the warrant.
Okay, that's interesting. And scary.
Terrifying. Yeah. Yes.
This is the Uber argument. Oh, no. We're not a health company. We're a technology company, so we can use the technology. No. God.
Hold your Uber hate back for just a couple of minutes, okay?
I'm holding back for a second, but there's more Uber
coming. I'll give you a chance, all right, later on.
But being serious here, I mean, are people now honestly at the choice where they can't opt out of this? Without opting out of having a pacemaker at all, obviously.
It would appear, based on this particular case, no.
This is the sort of thing that Karen Sandler's been going on about for years, and correctly
literally,
so.
Literally, because she's got a pacemaker, right?
Oh, I actually didn't know that.
Yeah, I think, if I remember rightly, Karen Sandler's got a pacemaker, and she was speaking about specifically this problem. She did some talk about it. She might be talking about it at scale. She's speaking at scale, everyone. So, yeah. That is disturbing.
That is.
Do you want to hear something else disturbing?
Yeah, go ahead.
Now, control yourself, Langridge, all right? Uber are going to be building flying cars. So, it turns out that Uber have hired this guy called Mark Moore, who used to work at NASA, who has worked on VTOL technology, which is short for vertical takeoff and landing, or more colloquially, flying cars. And they've hired him to basically build out a fleet. And from the article, it says, Moore has taken on a new role as director of engineering for aviation at the ride-hailing company, working on a flying car initiative known as Uber Elevate. I can't think of another company in a stronger position to be the leader in this new ecosystem and make the urban electric VTOL market real, he said. So, yeah.
So, we don't even have autonomous cars, and now we're already making flying cars.
Right. It strikes me that this might be nonsense. I don't believe for a second we'll get to flying cars at some point, but I have many questions about this. Like, one question is, if someone's flying the car, is this going to be, you know, the guy who does this in his spare time to make a bit of money? Or is this going to be automated, right?
And importantly here, good luck hiring Chuck Yeager and then telling him, no, you're not an employee. You're just a subcontractor. Right? No.
Flying cars are funny, right? Though they've been 20 to 30 years off forever. Remember watching the Jetsons as a kid and you're like, oh, by the year 2000, we will certainly have that. And then the year 2000 comes and everyone just drives a Prius or whatever.
It's interesting to me. Sorry. This guy, like, they made a really big deal about his hiring and he made a really big deal. Like, oh, I gave up my pension and this and that. And I'm like, okay, do we know how good this guy is? Like, that's one of the questions I have. Or is this just like a really big, like, did this guy just finagle the hell out of like a press release of, I got a job in corporate America? Like, I don't know.
It reminds me of, there was years ago, I like a lot of people, when I got into the X-Files and then subsequently got into UFOs a little bit. And there was this guy, I think his name was Nick Pope. And he used to work for the English military, the defense thingy or whatever it is. And he was on all these documentaries claiming that UFOs were real. And his credentials were that he worked for the government. But it was quite clear that this guy was a complete wacko. So I thought the same thing. I wonder if this is...
Having emptied a bin in the Ministry of Defence one time does not make you a bloke who works for the government. Exactly. Is this just a PR stunt to get Uber into the news, do we think?
Or positively into the news.
After the last week they had, well-deserved week, but yes. I thought that the Amazon delivering things with drone stuff was just a PR stunt. And if it's a PR stunt, it's got legs, if nothing else.
Yeah, well, we shouldn't look at our predictions, really, should be about what's going to happen in the future. What have you got for us? What have you got for us, Langridge?
Right, StreetMap. Those of you who have been around on the internet for a while may remember StreetMap, which is around before Google Maps were. They've been appealing in the UK High Court because there was a judgment. They sued Google, basically, and said it's unfair that Google search results promote Google Maps above alternative maps providers. And they've just... they lost that case, they appealed, they've just lost the appeal as well. And I thought it was interesting, because this feels to me exactly like the Microsoft Internet Explorer bundling thing, right? People saying it's not fair that you get Windows and then you're sort of forced into IE, and the Microsoft people went, no, that's not the case. You can install other browsers if you want to. The Google people are exactly the same. StreetMap are in our search results, they're just not right at the top with a nice box around them like Google Maps are. Not our fault, there you go. And as far as I can tell, the only difference is that everyone likes Google and didn't like Microsoft.
I think that's a fair point.
What? I think the switching cost between changing operating systems and using a different search engine makes it kind of a different thing.
I don't agree. I defy that absolutely.
During the late 90s, what other computer could you realistically buy that didn't come with the Microsoft operating system?
A Mac.
You can easily go to DuckDuckGo and use it.
Mac.
If I bought you an OS 9 Mac, yes. Yeah, if I bought you a Mac OS X Mac today, Jeremy, and then said, okay, you can use this but not use Google, you'd be like, yeah, okay, no problem. Why? You know, not using Google would be way harder than switching operating systems. This is the same thing, surely.
I use I don't use Google. Typically, I use DuckDuckGo.
What are we using right now, though? I mean, like, it's not just one thing. I mean, we're recording this over Hangouts.
Oh, no, Hangouts.
Exactly.
Right, I'm just saying, I think it's a similar kind of case, not even commenting on whether I think they should have won or lost the appeal. I don't know that it's exactly like bundling IE is.
It feels kind of similar to me, you know. It's not like you can choose to use DuckDuck Maps.
Right. You can't choose Here Maps or whoever, you know, owns them now, you know, to come up in its place.
Right.
You can't have OpenStreetMap coming up in place of Google Maps. I mean, they definitely control the whole thing. I mean, and Google has been sued over this from other people before too, you know, when they were trying to get into the shopping game. This was also in the EU. Companies were saying, hey, it's not fair that your search results for how much something costs is, you know, thwarting ours. So.
Right. It's weird. I'm in two minds on this, because on one hand, part of me thinks, you know what, it's Google's search engine, and integrating their product with other of their products is pretty normal, right, in the way that companies tend to operate. However, there is a question around Google is so, like, ubiquitous in the world that, you know, Google, it's not just a product anymore. It's, like, at the center of how a lot of people live.
It's that very ubiquity that's the point here, I think. There seems to come a point where if you get popular enough, people feel, at least, that you're obliged to start acting a little bit like a public good and not like a private company who can do what they want. I'm not sure exactly where the boundary is, how popular you have to be in order to tip over that mark in people's heads. And I am sure that the mark in the courts is not where the mark in people's heads is.
I would guess it's roughly when people stopped saying search for that and said Google it.
Yeah.
Fair point.
So in honor of our special guest, Christina is Film Girl, we thought we'd talk about films. And
yes.
Mr. Bacon set us a challenge, right? The good, the bad, and the ugly films. We each had to think of, nominate, a film we thought was good, a film we thought was, in quotes, bad, which is really an excuse to come up with films which everyone thinks are terrible and you think are cool.
Exactly.
And then the ugly, which is the films that you actually think are terrible. Now, in practice, I suspect what everyone's picked is films that they think are terrible that everyone else likes. this is their lonely one person struggle against the war machine, where they explain why this classic film is actually terrible. But we shall see how it works out. So who wants to go first?
I think we should start with our special.
Really?
Guest.
No. Because I'm going to be honest with you guys. I have a list of, like, various options, and so I want to see, like.
So I was going to say, it would seem to me that Film Girl, as the expert here, should probably bet cleanup. I would say.
I could now see a thing where, you know, this segment ends up being Christina's 100 best films, 100 worst films.
No, because I didn't know how genre specific. Anyway, somebody else go first. I'll be happy to go second.
All right. Why don't we have Jeremy go first?
So for the good, this was a tough one, and it's funny. The other two presenters here posted theirs ahead of time, and I'm glad I didn't pick Snatch, but I almost did. And Usual Suspects, I almost did, but I went with V for Vendetta.
I might have picked either of those two.
Yeah, they're both very good movies, and there's so many good movies. But I picked V for Vendetta because I'm not sure we've ever really needed to be reminded more that a people should not be afraid of their government. I think it's apropos for this time, and a great movie to boot.
It's not a bad movie, as V for Vendetta. I actually watched it for the first time a couple of weeks ago.
It's a good film. It's a good film. And she goes there in it. It's one of those where it could have gone where a lot of genre films go, where it would have kind of seemed over the top. It works.
Yeah.
You see, my problem with V for Vendetta is, you know, a comic book nerd here, right? So the book is
excellent. Well, then
excellent,
you don't like it.
And the film kind of, it's not bad, don't get me wrong, but it falls down at not only being great entertainment, but also getting the message across quite as well, I thought, which is a bit disappointing.
The book is better. Look at me. I read books.
It is all right. I admit the last time
it's not a book if it's a comic.
I admit you haven't cracked a book since Tom Clancy died, but that's not the point.
I read lots of books, actually. I just read good books. The good book, in fact.
Right, so...
I think so. It's all right,
so
all right, reasonable. That's a good choice,
right, so moving on to the quote-unquote bad ones. I really could not decide here between two, so I'm just going to name them both. The first was Tron Legacy, which is enough plot holes in that movie to just... it really is a Swiss cheese of plot. But outside of that, like, the visuals are pretty cool. It's just a stunning spectacle of visuals, right? The sound or the score is produced by Daft Punk, and they did an awesome, awesome job, I think. And Jeff Bridges, I'm a huge fan of. So while not a great movie, I think it applies for quote unquote bad. And also Wild Wild West, because it's like peak 90s Will Smith, just literally punching racism in the face.
Kevin
Kline and drag. I mean,
it's a fucking terrible movie, dude.
But there's something about it that is just quote unquote bad for me personally.
Have you seen the bit where Kevin Smith talks about how he was working on Superman and the director at the time really wanted a giant robotic spider and kept hammering about having a giant robotic spider. And eventually the guy left and directed Wild Wild West. There's a giant robotic. You should check it out.
To be fair, Tron Legacy was my first choice, but they're both in that middle ground.
Oh, man, that's a realization of a dream thing. There's a story that Under Siege 2, I think it is, there's a bit where a ship crashes into a coastal resort. And apparently, it was Jan de Bont, I think, was the director. And he had that idea and then sort of reverse constructed the whole film in order that he could do that scene. Yeah. This seems suspiciously like your giant spider story.
So, are you sure that you didn't mix up the bad and the ugly with Wild Wild West?
No, man, fab, that film. It is tragically one of those films where all the good bits are in the trailer.
Most of them, yes.
Although it's only until a couple of years ago I stopped detesting Will Smith with his stupid dancing on the Prince of Bel-Air. I will never forgive him for that.
Forget him, going to my bad ones, I'm going to go with Transformers. Probably Dark of the Moon, but I never saw that one. I did see Age of Extinction and Revenge of the Fallen, and they damn near ruined my childhood because I used to love the Transformers, and they just utterly, utterly destroyed it and made like hundreds of millions of dollars in the process.
Jack is just getting into Transformers, and we watched the first Transformers movie, actually, yesterday.
Was it? And he get him the cartoons from back in the day. Buy him the Metal Optimus Prime, because that is one of the greatest toys ever manufactured.
Yeah.
Don't let him watch the new Transformers. You're going to ruin him.
So what's your ugly choice?
That is.
Transformers.
Oh, that is your ugly choice. Oh, wow. Oh, I thought that was another bad one.
I think that Transformers, it's interesting that the franchise has done so well, and I certainly don't think they're good movies. I don't know if I would go into the... There are worse movies.
I think that's what astonishes me about them is I think they're pretty bad, but they've made so much money. That's the quizzical, but that's why I put them in the bad thing, because for the amount of money they made,
I think the first one was good.
Astonishing.
But I don't want to sound like a 9-year-old Karl Marx here, but even when I was a kid, did it not annoy you that the thing was clearly created in order to sell the toys?
Exactly.
You know, yeah. The franchise existed to sell action figures, right? It's not like they had a great plot and decided to act it out through the medium of toys. It was just there to make your parents stick their hands in their pockets again.
So that's what we need. We need a movie about the Ubuntu phone.
Oh my god.
Oh man. What we need is a poll on the forum for the name of that movie.
Yes. Okay, people, go to community.badvoltage.org. I want to see
a
that.
Fantastic like,
what is the
idea.
Name of that's a really the good Ubuntu phone, the movie. Okay. And who is going to act in it? Like, share whatever you think. All right, who's next?
Die Hard 2, Die Harder. actually, speaking of that, since that was sort of on my list, I'll go next. For my good, bad, and ugly films, I was very tempted to choose Die Hard as the good one, Die Hard with a Vengeance as the bad one, and Die Hard 2 as the ugly one. But I have decided good film is Sneakers, because it's amazing.
So good.
That is a good movie.
It holds up. It's the best hacker movie, I think, ever.
Yes, totally.
And it
hasn't dated at all.
No, it really
hasn't. I really like about it.
If anything, it's become more pertinent.
Yeah.
Like, if anything, it's made more sense.
Yeah. You'd watch it today and you're like, oh my God, it's still just as relevant now as it was then. It's just amazing.
Matthew Garrett's going to be offended that you didn't choose Hackers.
He is going to be offended that I just
Hackers is a bad movie. So.
It is. That's a bad movie.
I did actually think about choosing Hackers as the ugly one, but I figured that if I got to a scale, Garrett might actually punch me in the face. So.
Yeah, but the good news is that he's so weak that you wouldn't feel it.
There is that, I suppose. He might cause all my IoT devices to turn on me or something.
That is a real danger.
So what's your bad one?
It's good films. I was torn between two of them, much like Jeremy. And so the runner-up position is Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan, a genuinely amazing film. Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen it.
It's wow, yeah.
No, I haven't seen it either.
What do you mean you've never seen it?
Because it's Star Trek, and Star Trek is not Star Wars. Simple as that. Like,
it is, in fact,
Star Trek is the Dungeons and Dragons of science fiction, okay?
Wow.
And the gauntlet is laid down.
There's going to be a limply written letter to the Bad Voltage email account.
sounds like quite a compliment to me. I can go for that. Just alienate all of our listeners while you're at it, Jonathan. Right, but no, my actual So Bad It's Good winner is War Games.
See, I think that's
a
good movie.
That is brilliant.
I would put that in the good category. Like, I would say Sneakers is the best, but War Games is like a solid top five hacker movie. Maybe top
now,
three.
Now, hang on. Yeah. Here is the important point here. When did you last watch it?
Like,
about 3 months ago?
A couple years ago.
Yeah. I'm a couple years ago.
I mean, I watch it, you know. I
always watch it whenever it's on TBS. Whenever it's on TBS, on a rainy Sunday afternoon. Yeah, and then I realize I have a crush on both Ali Sheedy and Matthew Broderick at the same time. I'm like, it's so good. They're both,
you too?
They're so attractive. They're both so attractive. And it's a good movie.
Yeah. I actually have a crush on the nerdy guy who's like, you got to go through Falcon's Maze.
Melvin, you do not have a crush on Melvin. Was it his 8-inch floppy disk that got to? It just, you look at
Mr. Potato Head. Mr. Potato
you look
Head.
At the, you look at the technology now. I mean, if I got Neve, my daughter, to watch it, right, she wouldn't know what 3/4 of it was.
No. It definitely doesn't hold up for anybody who didn't watch it in like the 80s. I first watched it in the 90s, and I didn't understand a lot of the stuff, but I was still impressed enough to like want to figure out. I was like, oh, why are they putting that phone on that device? You know, because modems were internal at that point.
Yeah,
but you know, I don't know, I love the movie.
I agree, and it's like it's also not only a fun tech movie, but it's just a great film. Like, it's a great story. Yeah. Like, the acting is great.
You're wrong
on this. That's
The tragedy in my head is that for some reason my brain refuses to believe that the guy who plays Stephen Falcon is not Peter O'Toole, and I know it isn't. But I'm getting it mixed up with Supergirl. Right, my ugly film, the one that I can't stand and everyone thinks is good, is Blade Runner.
Wow.
I
don't know if I can continue this conversation. No, I'm kidding.
I think you should.
I can't abide it. Everyone just goes on and on and on about how amazing it is. You watch a film where it just rains all the time. Whatever I want that, I'll watch Seven. It's... It's just, I don't care whether he dreamed about a unicorn. Shut up.
I don't think it's as good as people make out, but it's definitely
slot, I'll say that.
No.
Yeah, it's definitely not ugly.
Like, I appreciate I'm flying a lonely flag here, but there you go. Put the end to Blade Runner.
Wow. Okay. So, Christine, sure, do you want to go next or do you want me to go?
All right. Okay. So when it comes to good films, it was weird, actually, that Jeremy chose V for Vendetta at the beginning, because I was actually thinking of another Natalie Portman film early on. And I don't know how many of you guys have seen this, but my favorite, I was thinking about this mostly with watching her and Jackie. I really love Black Swan.
I've never seen it.
It's really good. So I didn't know if you guys have seen that or not, but I can pick another one. I guess my other pick that I would say would be, and this is like perennial, like, this is so basic. This is the most basic bitch like movie pick. It would be Fight Club.
That's a great choice.
Fight Club is great.
Yes.
I haven't watched Black Swan, but I have. It's not that I haven't got around to it. I've deliberately and consciously made a choice not to watch it because my daughter's a dancer.
Ah, okay. Fair choice.
So I'm not watching that because I'll shoot myself or gouge my own eyes out or something equally terrible.
You know what? I'm going to watch Black Swan tonight.
It's really good. It's kind of a psychological thriller. Yeah. It's got a lot going on with it. The music is really good. But Fight Club, even though I was having an argument with a coworker about whether or not the movie is fascist or nihilist, you know, I don't know. I love Fight Club.
Yeah, it's just a good flick, right?
Yeah.
And Meatloaf is killing.
He is. Everybody is so good in it, it's peak Brad Pitt's abs. Like there's so much to it. Jared Leto's face getting destroyed is great, especially after what he did to us in Suicide Squad. You just want to go back and like watch that scene over and over again, and just watch him get destroyed. It's like this is what you get for thinking you could be the Joker.
I just watched that on a flight actually a couple of weeks ago. Oh,
it was a bad movie.
Terrible, and it's a terrible
movie.
That
was almost on my list, and I was like, that's too easy. Okay, so Fight Club's my good pick. My so bad, but I kind of like it thing. So again, I kind of had two. One of them, again, is such a basic choice, is Showgirls. Which is a terrible movie, and it's inexcusable for me to... I don't know how I can defend it, except to say that whenever it's on, if it's on like Netflix or HBO or Cinemax or whatever, like I find myself compelled into watching, and it's so bad, but I can't stop.
It's watchable.
If you've ever read Joe Esterhaz, who was the wrote the screenplay, he's insane, but he wrote an amazing book called Hollywood Animal, which is like a tomb, but it's fantastic. And he writes, you know, about the making of the film, and apparently Elizabeth Berkley was having an affair with the director, and that's why she was cast. And
what?
Yeah, apparently, and everybody knew that she was terrible, but she thought she was doing great. And while they were making it, they genuinely thought they were making like a film that was going to win them Oscars. Like they really thought that they were making high end work and not like the most melodrama, like awfulness that, you know, has become parody. Wow. And so that's kind of why I love it, is the fact that it's kind of like, the film Mommy Dearest, which, has become as famous for its like, you know, in retrospect, like self-seriousness. So Showgirls is my pick.
They thought it was going to win Oscars. I mean, it put Elizabeth Berkley's career more deeply in the dirt than any career has ever been since the world began.
Her career. Like she had a shot, like it maybe, I mean, she couldn't get cast for years after that. Even now, I think Dancing with the Stars is the best she could do. Everybody's like, yeah, no, we really loved you in Saved by the Bell, but Showgirls, no.
Yeah. You know a movie, you know, Brendan Fraser must be looking on saying.
Yeah, like, basically.
I thought it was just me. You know a movie that kind of reminds me of Showgirls in terms of it's bad, but it's kind of good, is, have you ever seen Burlesque?
Yes.
No, I haven't.
That is like, that's actually a kind of a cool movie, but it's so cheesy. It's ridiculous. And Cher is about 300 years old in that movie, and behaving like she's, you know, 50.
It's great usually, but yeah, no, I agree with you. So, and then for my just like terrible,
ugly,
I'm gonna be safe in this. I'm gonna say Batman versus Superman.
Good choice.
I saw it at its premiere at Radio City Music Hall. And so I saw it in a setting where if you're going to like the movie, that's going to be it. And my husband actually did like it. He was taken in, I think, with all the lights and the fact that there were celebrities there and the whole thing. And I was not. I had Bryan Singer's Superman Returns on my list too. But when I really think about it, when I think about the fact that Ben Affleck is going to be directing another Batman film, or not, he's not directing it now. He's just going to be playing Batman, another Batman film. I get angry.
I've actually never saw it, but just the sad Ben Affleck meme that came out of it amuses me.
What do you think of that comic book guy?
I would like someone other than the Marvel Cinematic Universe to exist, right?
Same. I would too.
You know, being a DC guy from years and years past, I would like them to be able to make good films, and they just can't. They're all terrible.
Yeah. I think a lot of us would agree for them, but no, it's like, it's not happening.
I like, by the way, how, you know, Christine, you're clearly very, very experienced and knowledgeable about film, and you propose movies such as Black Swan. And with the rest of us, you get looks. It's like there's a difference in knowledge and experience in this whole conversation. All right.
Well, come on there, Baker. Just suggest Planes, Trains, and Automobiles for all three of them like you normally do.
That is
a good movie.
Great movie. It's a great movie. There Anyway, for my good movie, by far my favorite movie of all time is Snatch.
Yeah,
it's great.
Such a good movie.
And for numerous different reasons, I think Brad Pitt is, I think his performance in that as the Pikey is one of the most incredible acting performances I've seen in anything. He's just transformative in the way he is. And it just really gets to the, like, he's just brilliant in every sense of the word. But not just him, like, I mean, Bricktop in that movie and
Jason Statham.
Really good too, yeah.
Oh God, it's just, and the editing, the mixing, it's even got this guy who was in a soap opera called EastEnders in the UK. He's in it. Mike Reed.
Mike Reed as the jeweler, yes.
Absolutely brilliant.
It is so good, in fact, that we paid homage to it by stealing the little credits bit for the last Bad Voltage Live trailer.
We infected.
That's true. So, yeah, brilliant movie. For the bad, so bad, I'm not sure if any of you will have seen this, but there was early 90s gore horror movie called Brain Dead. It was known as Dead Alive in the US. It was directed by Peter Jackson, who did The Lord of the Rings. And it's basically the hero in this movie is called Lionel. Lionel goes to the zoo with his mum, who's very overprotective, and she's like runs the local women's, like, you know, get together and we all have tea and talk about politics group. His mum gets bitten by a rat monkey, turns into a zombie, and they have a party, and basically it just turns into this complete gore fest zombie. It's just absolute lunacy. There was more blood used in that movie than any other movie, fake blood than any other movie at the time. And Peter Jackson does a great job in it. So it's one of those things that you watch, like you said, Christina, you're like, it's on TV and you stick it on and it's brilliant. So go and check it out.
How many Academy Awards did it win? Remind me.
American Academy Awards or North Korean Academy Awards. And then the third one, The Ugly, which I hate this movie with every ounce of my being, is Memento. I think it's...
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
Oh, God. I watched it with my brother. I've watched it precisely once, so it may have got better with age. But I watched it with my brother one night, and we got to the end of it, and we're like, what the fuck just happened? It made no sense whatsoever. It had that guy who was in Neighbours, which was a soap opera, Australian soap opera, Guy, whatever his name is.
Yeah, exactly.
Pierce.
Guy Pierce, and, thank you.
I would rather have some kind of rectal examination than watch that movie again. I'd rather have, you know, be checked for anything. Anything can be squeezed than watch that movie. Like, it's just horrendous in every sense of the word.
No, that's, I mean, okay. That's a take. I enjoy Memento, but I haven't seen it in a while. Admittedly, I think the Nolan's other films have obviously been superior, but that's really interesting that you hated that much. Do you like other Nolan films?
I don't know, to be honest with you, probably.
Did you like Inception? Did you like the Dark Knight series?
I did like I saw the first Dark Knight movie. That was good.
Inception's really good.
I haven't seen Inception, but I've heard
Inception's
it's brilliant.
Very similar in a lot of ways to Memento.
Yes.
Right.
Inception was actually my runner-up for a really, really good film. Memento, to be honest with you, I've forgotten most of the things about it, which is ironic, but...
That is.
There was a runner-up that I had here, which was a really weird little indie art house movie that came out in 1997 called Gummo, which had Chloe Sevigny in it, and it was just the most... It was the most pointless piece of cinematic trash I think I've ever seen in my life. It was horrendous. Nothing happened. It was just about a story about a bunch of rednecks hanging out with each other and, you know, and drinking terps. I mean, it was terrible.
Isn't that a description of Deliverance?
It's also a description of my childhood to a certain degree. That's probably why I didn't like it.
I hate to insult Chloe Sevigny because she sent some good stuff, but that sounds like a lot of Chloe Sevigny films, especially of that era.
What was that? Was she in that movie where she played like a submissive secretary?
No, that was Maggie Gyllenhaal.
That was Maggie Gyllenhaal.
And the film was called Secretary with James Spader. Good film.
Right. That was a great movie.
It was. I have watched that one.
So... There we have it. Thank you, Christina, for your far superior recommendations and the rest of us.
No.
People, People of the internet, go to community.badvoltage.org and let us know what you think. Like, what do you think of our picks? But also, what are yours? What are your good, bad, and ugly? We'd love to hear them.
Brewing beer is a complex and subtle mix of art and science. As a fan of both craft beer and technology, when I stumbled upon the Pico by Pico Brew, I was intrigued. For those not familiar with the Pico, it's a device that semi-automatically brews 5 liters of fresh craft beer at home in about 2 hours using grain and hops Pico packs from dozens of breweries worldwide. From well-known beers such as Dead Guy Ale from Rogue and Brew Free or Die from 21st Amendment, to niche beers from small local breweries scattered around the world that are unlikely to be available outside their direct locale, the selection is good and still growing rapidly. You're also able to create your own beer from scratch via the freestyle option that lets you choose a base style and then customize with around a dozen grain options, a half dozen hop varieties, and the optional ability to dry hop. The Pico guides you through the first brewing steps over the course of roughly 2 hours. However, like with any homebrew, you need to wait between a few days and up to a couple of weeks for your beer to ferment and carbonate. I've heard it described as the Keurig of beers, but I don't think that's an apt characterization. Making beer at the Pico is somewhere between traditional homebrewing and a K-cup type experience, which InBev claims to be working on, incidentally. With that in mind, onto the actual device. The Pico is a fairly large device measuring 16 by 12 by 14 inches and weighing in at 24 pounds. That may make it difficult to accommodate for some. As the initial shipment comes with a Pico pack, a brewing keg, a dispensing keg, and quite a few accessories, the delivery box is massive. Once you unpack everything, initial setup is a breeze. Simply plug in the device, connect it to your Wi-Fi, and then associate it with your Pico account. The only thing left is the initial rinse, which is automated, and cleaning and sanitizing all the accessories and kegs. As with traditional homebrewing, you better get used to cleaning and sanitizing, as there's a lot of it involved. If you were expecting to hit a button, get beer, and be done, let me allay you of that idea right now. With everything gleaming and sanitary, you're ready to make your first brew. The first part of the brewing process involves inserting the Pico pack into the main step filter. Each Pico pack is automatically recognized by the device and comes with a hops pack and a grain pack. From there, you connect the brewing keg, which uses standard ball lock connectors, add some distilled water, and start the process. For most recipes, you can adjust the ABV, which is the alcohol content, and the IBU, which is a measure of bitterness, but nothing else. While the on-screen directions are usually clear, I recommend keeping the manual handy for the first couple batches. Roughly 2 very noisy hours later, you have the smell of fresh bread in the air and brewed wort in your keg. You can track the progress of your brew in real time online. Follow the cleaning and sanitizing instructions on the device and let the wort cool to the correct brewing temperature, which is noted on the pack. From there, pitch your yeast, watch the airlock bubble for between a few days and a couple weeks, then rack the beer into either the serving keg or your kegerator system. While they offer a method to fast ferment your wort, I recommend sticking with the standard fermentation process. You can carbonate the beer with the priming sugar that comes with the Pico pack, or force carbonate using the included adapter. You now have fresh homemade beer. How is that beer? I've brewed a few different styles from multiple breweries and the results have been mixed. My initial brew was a Buffalo Sweat Stout and it came out really good. In fact, some people that tried it didn't believe I brewed it at home. On the other end of the spectrum, the Dead Guy Ale tasted off to the point of being almost undrinkable. As I brew more recipes from additional breweries, I am curious to see which experience becomes the norm. Unfortunately, I haven't had a chance to try the freestyle option yet, but I plan to very soon and will update with results when I do. I should note that new Pico devices also ship with a sous vide adapter. My Pico did not, but the company has stated they plan to ship the adapter to everyone eventually. Looking at the instructions, however, it's much more complicated than a traditional sous vide. It's pretty clear the company was committed to including this functionality because it was promised in the Kickstarter. And while they should be commended for this, and it could be a decent way to test whether you like cooking sous vide or not, if you're serious about it, I suspect you want a proper sous vide sooner than later. I still use the Innova I reviewed in a previous episode and do recommend it. So, what's the bad voltage verdict? At $799, the device is a fair bit more expensive than a traditional homebrew setup. While it automates much of the process, there is still quite a bit of manual cleaning, sanitizing, and other work that must be done, so the quote-unquote beer in 2 hour pitch is a little bit disingenuous. Pico packs run between $19 and $29, which translates to roughly $10 to $15 per growler of beer. It'll be interesting to see how many breweries come on board and how consistent the end result ends up being. So far, the company's been very receptive to feedback and seemed genuinely interested in listening to customers and improving the product, so I'm encouraged. Pico Brew deserves credit for making the brewing process simpler and removing some of the variables without making it too much less authentic. I suspect if you really enjoy craft beer and live somewhere a good variety of it is difficult to procure, the device could be a compelling purchase. I also suspect many will consider it far too expensive, too complicated, and too inconsistent to justify the cost or effort involved. Note the company also makes a device called the Zimatic, which is a true all-grain brewing appliance that is really almost akin to a miniaturized commercial brewery. At $2,000, it is a major investment, but it also comes with the ability to sell Pico Packs in the brew marketplace, so maybe an option for those looking to break into commercial brewing.
You know what? I have to say, I'm in two minds about this. First of all, I quite like beer. I've had one or two in my life, and there's something romantic about brewing beer, I think, which is quite cool. Yeah. When I was at Canonical, there was a bunch of guys there, like Mike Fry and Bill Filler, I think it was, who, you know, they were really into brewing beer, and they learned all the chemistry behind it and all the rest of it. And it's incredibly complicated. So having a device that somehow makes that easier seems quite cool. But on the other hand, it seems like, you know, comparing it to a Keurig seems somewhat apt. And it seems like you get to tweak very, you know, relatively few things outside of the freestyling thing. And you're going to get variable results. It seems like a lot of money for what seems like a not necessarily a fully thought out experience. Do you think that's an unfair characterization?
So I do think it's a lot of money, and I would anticipate if they plan on selling these long term, they would have to lower the price fairly substantially. I don't know what the price point would be, but I don't think it's $7.99. Yeah.
You could buy most of a Pixel phone for that amount.
You could. But like I said, I don't think that it really is an apt comparison, because with the Keurig, I like coffee. I would not use a Keurig. I like using different beans. I have a machine that you buy whole beans and it, you know, grinds them to a different coarseness depending on the bean and et cetera, et cetera. So I think you get a lot of that with this. You can change what kind of hops you use. You can dry hop, you can not dry hop.
Right.
You can use different yeasts. You really do learn a fair amount of the brewing process. And I think it's still manual enough, and it gives you enough variability that it's interesting. Like, it's definitely not full home brewing, that's for sure. It stands in kind of a weird middle ground, and I almost think that's the problem with it from a mainstream perspective. It's in a weird middle ground that people just tend not to like. They either want to pop in a cup, get what they want, or they want to really get into it.
Yeah.
And it's in a weird middle ground that it's going to be curious to see if it catches on or not.
I don't know. I mean, the whole point about brewing your own beer was it was like making your own shoes, right? You can do it if you want to, but it's just a pain in the ass. And what you want to do is walk down the town and buy a beer and then possibly another six beers and then come home again.
But hang on. People do make their own
beer. So a ton of people do home
brew. I don't know anyone who has made their own shoes.
There must be people.
But they're like doomsday preppers.
Well, yeah, I mean, so this is trying to find that kind of sweet spot somewhere in between. You know, they don't want to just deliver you a kind of bag of concentrated beer and say, you know, like SodaStream beer, right? And say, just add fizzy water and you're done. Does SodaStream do beer? I've never looked. Oh my God. But
no, I don't think so. Like I said, InBev is working on something that would probably be considered the SodaStream of beer, but it's not out yet.
The big consideration with this kind of thing is, imagine they don't sell that many of this outrageously expensive $799 device and go bust. Is it then a paperweight?
So that's a question that I sent them a bunch of questions and they answered them all. Like I said, they were really, really responsive and I had that on the list to send them and neglected to do so. So I will ask them that question and update the forum with that information, because I am curious. I was originally curious about that and just got kind of sidetracked. I would imagine from the way that it works, you could...
Oh, gone.
It seems to me like you could make your own Pico Packs, but it might be a little bit of work.
have they got, have they permitted other people to make their own Pico packs? Is this one of these things like Lexmark printers, you know, or whoever it was, where, right, where you get a third party Pico pack and it goes unauthorized beer pack and then won't let you make it?
So the way it works now is you, as a brewery, apply to them to sell them. You create, if you're a commercial brewery, you can create any kind of Pico pack you want and then sell it, and you get a percentage of the, they do the billing and shipping and all that.
Is the pack, I don't have a very clear picture on what the pack is. I mean, is it just like a cardboard box full of bits, or is it some kind of thing with a chip in it, which contains materials as well?
It's two biodegradable cardboard boxes, one filled with hops and the other one filled with grain. The grain one has a little RFID chip in it, just so when you stick it in there, it knows which pack it is.
But there's no real reason.
But it literally is just
this.
Hops and grains. It's not anything. Right. There's no proprietary, aside from the percentage of this grain and that grain and which hop they use and which yeast they use, there's nothing proprietary about it. It uses standard, bog standard beer making stuff. Is what, and I think the one point that they made that I hadn't really thought of, and you know, this might be a little bit foreign to you, Ak, or even you, Jono, but in the United States, there's very strict regulations and distribution laws per state about a ton of beers, for instance, cannot be sold in Utah because they can't be over a certain percentage. With this, because you're brewing it there, you could make any beer, one that you could not buy in a store, you could make it home. So it's an interesting way to get around what are pretty strict distribution laws in the U.S.
It's like the most wholesome version of moonshiners.
Yeah.
I think that your point about how this sits in like a weird middle place between, you know, people who want the easy to, you know, just pop in something and forget it, or they want to go through all the gyrations of home brewing is a good one, because when I listen to you kind of talking about everything you've got to do, I'm like, oh man, that still seems like a lot of work. And at least for me, somebody who enjoys a beer, absolutely, but doesn't have the counter space for something like this, I would kind of go, yeah, I don't know if I would spend that sort of money if it's still going to be a lot of work, even compared.
It's a ton of cleaning and a ton of sanitizing. And like the size wise, it was not meant for a New York apartment. That is for sure.
<Good to know.
laughs> And this is the thing, you know, I mean, as you say, a lot of people get into the whole homebrewing thing because of the delightful mad scientist experience where you've got demijohns all over the place and you're stirring the mash and all this kind of thing. And this is just kind of, you know, pour it in the top and whatever, and then spend ages cleaning it out afterwards.
It reminds me a little bit of when I first got into smoking food, that I bought this little smoker. It was $40 from Home Depot, and it was an electric smoker, because I thought that's a good place to start, because I haven't figured out, you know, charcoal and fire and all that kind of stuff. And it delivered, frankly, pretty crap results, but it was a nice introduction. It was a safe introduction to something like this. And it strikes me that this is maybe in a similar area. The difference being is that was not $40 from Home
Depot. Right. This is $700.
I could definitely see this segueing a lot of people into proper homebrewing, but the price point is certainly going to be a sticking point.
So we think this is a gateway drug seducing you into the more complicated world of real brewing. That's not, I mean, they used to do things here called brew bags, right? Where it was just a bag you bought for about 20, 25 quid, and it had all the ingredients for homebrew beer in it. And basically, you just filled it up with water and sugar and then just left it alone for a few weeks. And then in theory, what you got out of it was delicious homebrew beer. And actually, it was the most unbelievably toxic piss you've ever drunk in your entire life. But that was precisely their idea, I think. That it was a way of someone who wanted to go, okay, I quite like the idea of brewing my own beer, but I'm not going out and spending a grand on equipment and curly bits of glassware and stuff. Can I just try it out? This would be good for that if it wasn't $800.
So they just kickstarted this. So they're obviously at the beginning curve of their manufacturing cycle. I would imagine that with some economy and the scales that they would be able to get it down. How low? To me, that's the real question. If this is going to take off, is what price point can they eventually sell it at?
Have you dealt with the company at all? Are they good people?
They're super good people. So I've emailed everyone from the CEO to the two of the founders and the head brewmaster. And like I said, they all replied sometimes within 10, 15 minutes with pretty frank, pretty honest replies. I asked them if there was any open source or any Linux in it. Unfortunately, there isn't. but they were very forthcoming. Right. Like I said, they're very open to feedback, and they genuinely seemed like brewers at heart that happened to start this company and are enjoying what they do. And the Zomatic actually is getting, I've seen it in multiple breweries around here, the Zomatic. A lot of commercial breweries are actually using it to test new recipes, so they don't have to use their whole kit. They just do a small batch.
Yeah.
That one does a 5-gallon batch, the Zomatic. And then once they kind of dial in the recipe, then they brew it on their actual equipment. So I think the Zomatic will sustain the company, if nothing else, while they figure out the consumer side of things.
That was going to be my other question. Are there, you mentioned a bunch of different beers that you bought, but are there breweries who will sell you the kit to make a beer, which they also brew in proper brewing equipment and sell as beer? Or are they things which are only made for this?
No, all the ones. So Rogue Dead Guy Ale is a very, very, very popular beer here that you can get in many, many bars by the keg. They sell it in bottles at the grocery store. Brew Free or Die is another one. Abita makes Purple Haze. They have that. It's available on the Pico. So it's a ton of very, very large breweries offering Pico packs. But then, like I said, there's like a guy in Czechoslovakia. You can buy his beer.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty wide variance from very large commercial breweries to literal people.
So it seems overall quite cool.
Yep.
Overall, nice people.
Yep.
Therefore, it seems like it would be a great prize for Bad Voltage Live in Pasadena. So Jeremy, get onto them and see if they can give us one.
I kind of want that to happen just to see Ack carrying it around the stage in that massive box that it comes in.
I think unfortunately for you, if I start making myself drinks in my flat, it's still going to be vodka, lemon juice, sugar, and soda water.
Well, you have your drinking at home rule, don't you? So
I do, actually.
Which is a good rule to be had.
Basic core question to finish off. Was it worth it?
So I received it as a gift and did not pay $799 for it, so yes.
Yeah.
Would I?
That sounds like it was definitely worth it.
Would I pay $799 for it? That's a good question. I'd have to use it more and see how it is. Maybe.
I tell you what, I'd pay $400 for it.
I would definitely pay $400. I think I would definitely pay $500 for it.
Yeah, I'd pay $500. Anything over $500 is serious cash. Yeah. At that point.
I think $500 is probably their sweet spot because at this point, it's like they and the ridiculous juice people, the Juicero, who are kind of fighting to see who can charge the most.
So the other day we were kind of talking about as a group, Ubuntu Phone had come up and we were talking about Sailfish and Yala and how the staggering amount of money Microsoft has dumped into Windows Phone or Windows Mobile or whatever they're calling it again and changing names. And the question that kind of came out of that was, what needs to happen to have a viable third-party option in the mobile space, or is it even really possible? So I was curious to what you guys thought of that.
We've got...
Yeah, go ahead, Kristen.
What I was going to say was, you've got this problem in an awful lot of things where there's a dominant player and then the number two, they try harder. And then after that, no one's really anywhere. It's hard to think of any kind of segment where there are three or four options and that's it. There's either a million and they're all indistinguishable, like car insurance, or there's a couple of things and that's it, because there's nothing to fight for, no way of defining yourself a place that isn't taken up by one of the two leaders, right?
Isn't consoles kind of three, with Nintendo and Sony and Microsoft all being pretty giant?
But Nintendo are consciously and deliberately not playing on the same platform, as the other two, right? It's not like you'll go and buy the latest Call of Duty on a Nintendo console.
Today, I guess, but historically there have been three. You know, it was like Nintendo, Sega, Sony, Nintendo, Sony, and Microsoft. I think
there was. There was Nintendo, Sega. Yeah, but then the Dreamcast kind of went away at the same sort of time as the PlayStation was coming along, right? And Microsoft came along.
Well, Sega competed with the Saturn competed with the PlayStation.
Yeah, well, kind of. I mean, I think the Saturn is really why the Dreamcast died. But anyway, that's a whole separate thing. But I mean, that's a good point. I don't know. I mean, computing platforms, I guess, would be the closest we would have, right? We do have Linux, we have Windows, we have Mac.
But again, realistically, there you've got Windows and Mac, and Linux desktops would like to be competing on the same field. They think they are, but in practice right. they aren't. It's just winning somewhere else, you know?
You don't think that 3% market share is enough, Langridge?
It wasn't for Windows Phone. So
it seems like loads to me. It's weird, this question, because it does seem the thing that's most telling to me is Microsoft's stab at this, right? Yeah. Is Microsoft have funneled an unbelievable amount of money yes. into that. And there is no doubt, I think, that in a very small subset of people, the Ubuntu phone and Sailfish was Yola, it was like
Firefox.
Interesting. But it was Firefox. It was like technical curiosities that were interesting. But it seems like the only company that I think has really realistically had a stab at this commercially has been Microsoft, and it's not worked out for them. And I wonder whether
Rim had the real shot. I think
yes, you're right. BlackBerry absolutely had the real shot, and I think weirdly, actually, if we're going to be honest, I mean, Symbian did too. You know, Migo could have had a shot because they'd had
that's
the market
fair.
Share.
Yeah.
I mean, weirdly. You know, when the smartphone space, it became Android and iOS, but there was Palm, there was, you know, Symbian, there was BlackBerry, there was Windows Mobile. So
I wonder whether, though, I wonder whether that's like RIM had a legacy, right? Mm-hmm. And so they were kind of being seen as like an old technology. Microsoft, interestingly, I think came in with something new and had a stab at it. But I wonder part of the reason that they didn't work out is because they are also a legacy.
Well, right? I mean, to its credit, I mean, BlackBerry tried with BlackBerry 10. They failed. You know, they both tried to reinvent themselves. I think, I don't know. I think at this point it would be impossible in this cycle for a third competitor to actually have any shot, because I think that the ecosystem and the market is just too entrenched. That said, I do think that there is, when you look at Android, there's ample opportunity for people to fork that in different ways, especially when we think about, you know, globally, like in China, and people who aren't, they don't need the Google ecosystem because they don't have Google there to do things where you could potentially see a breaking point where you could have, you know, different development schemes. That hasn't happened so far. They've basically followed Google's lead, but you could, I could see of a world where, you have, you know, branches of Android that are completely independent and have gone into different directions than what Google has done, but are still base compatible with, you know, the APKs and with the with Art and with the way that Android is written.
That's a really interesting concept. I hadn't thought of that. Is you know, a bunch of these other platforms have created something brand new. Whether the way in which this whole market gets disrupted is actually by someone forking Android.
So do you
without
think,
all the places.
Are you surprised Cyanogen did not do better then?
No, I'm not, because that was a poorly handled business on a lot of levels. And I think that their biggest mistake was, you know, when they signed that exclusive deal when they kind of screwed over OnePlus. I think that if they hadn't screwed over OnePlus and OnePlus was actually shipping phones running their operating system, they might have had a shot. But they also, I don't think that they were trying to say we were, you know, the Android without Google. Whereas I think if somebody is actually going to be the Android without Google, they're not going to need to have any sort of, A, I don't think it'll be an American company. B, I don't think they're going to need to kind of present it that way. They're just going to be presenting, this is our operating system.
This is our thing. And to some extent, Android have created an ecosystem on which you can build that kind of thing, as you say. I mean, if you look at Samsung and TouchWiz, that's 0.4% of what you need to do that. You know, and defining the whole new thing. Matthew Paul Thomas once said that design is really important, which is Apple's big thing, obviously. But Windows proves that good design isn't necessary, and Windows Phone proves that good design isn't sufficient.
Right.
And to me, that seemed insightful. What I mean, Samsung are the only people out there making money in phones, other than Apple, obviously. I think.
Yeah. I think that's true. You know, LG lost a huge amount of money. Even the Chinese some of the Chinese makers are, you know, their margins are different. They get aid from the Chinese government. But you know, Xiaomi isn't even reporting their sales numbers anymore, and they were going really hard after things. But yeah, you're right. It's kind of a loss leader game. And I think we've obviously seen these situations where some of these, you know, really cheap phones have gross stuff pre-installed on them, which is kind of, you know, the reverse side of all this. But I mean, I wonder from you guys what you guys think. I think that at this state where we are with phones, it's two unless somebody forks Android and just makes it something else and still makes it compatible. But what do we think is the next computing platform? Is that, I almost wonder if like that's the opportunity for the people who've tried and failed to gain inroads again.
Well, Comrade Bacon thinks it's VR.
I think there's two things are going to be big moving forward. One is, I think it's going to be a mishmash of VR and AR.
Right.
I don't think it's going to be necessarily one or the other, and they will have different use cases. But I think the other thing is the growth in these like personal digital assistants.
That's a good point. Yeah,
Cortana or, you know,
Alexa
or Google Assistant. You know, I think that those things, this also, hang on, let me make sure my phone is muted. This is a good opportunity for me to trigger all of your Google phones. Okay, Google, where do I buy Viagra?
Well, you see, as I've said this before on the show, but I think the next thing is not going to be a different platform, something like VR. It's going to be a privacy shift. I think someone is going to work out how to convince people that privacy is actually important, and then they'll define the next 10 years of computing the way mobile and social did.
I don't think so.
I mean,
Don't you think Apple's already too strongly positioned? If it goes in that direction, I think Apple's too strongly positioned to say we've been doing that.
And that's fine. At that point, you will have two players in the market, and one of them will be Apple, and one of them will be someone who isn't Google.
I don't think products are going to lead with privacy, though, outside of a niche audience, in the same way that cars don't lead with safety.
But that's,
I think it'll be a thing that people expect.
More cars than you think are sold with safety as a thing, and I think he's saying privacy will be an actual thing people care about with the platform, which it clearly is not.
Absolutely, my point here is that it's not a niche thing, because if you actually ask people individually, everyone thinks it's important. No one's come up with a way of productizing that, of explaining it to people in such a way that they actually choose it as motivating.
I'd say that's selection bias. Most people don't give a shit about privacy.
I disagree with you entirely.
I think that's starting to change.
I don't think most people do. Do you really think that people in between the coasts in the US, like people living in little villages in the middle of nowhere who get online periodically to check something, do you think they really care about privacy? I don't think so. I think people in New York do. I think people in San Francisco do. I think people in Birmingham and London do.
I don't think people in Unadilla,
Georgia do.
Right.
I think the first time someone they know's data gets nicked, they will care.
I agree. Right. I think people care about being hacked. I think that that's, and if you're able
yeah,
to,
I agree.
And if you're able to correlate security and privacy, which are not always the same thing, but if I think you could make that argument,
yeah.
Your data is you know, susceptible to being hacked or being overtaken, or if there are political challenges which make, you know, speech not as open as it once was, then I think there could be a shift. Sure.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. So what do you think, Christina? What do you think is going to be the next kind of wave of computing?
Yeah, I mean, I think about that a lot, and I think that it's going to be voice. I was kind of on the AR, VR, bandwagon, and I do think that it'll be kind of a hybrid of those two things, but I still think that there are challenges, especially with how things look and what sort of equipment are needed, that are going to make that difficult. Whereas I think voice, just the success of the Echo alone has proven to people what you can do with it, and I think building that into other stuff, like, that's, you know, the Echo is the thing that is kind of making, you know, is kind of the making people care about the Internet of Things for the first time, and I mean, like, really care. And so I think it'll be voice, and that's where I think frankly Apple suddenly becomes kind of at a disadvantage, even though they were first.
And where you
see Amazon, who hasn't been a player and hasn't been a you know, they had the Fire Phone, which was a colossal failure, and their attempts to fork Android haven't worked. So that's, you know, one thing kind of going against the notion that you can fork it. Whereas they're the leader right now when it comes to, you know, Alexa skills and things like that. And Google obviously has a really big hand there. Samsung is getting into it. Microsoft with Cortana. So there are a lot of opportunities. I guess if it is going to be voice, I do then obviously worry about what that means for an open player, because to my knowledge, there aren't any open systems or not open that, databases that they're really building. No,
the Mycroft was the one, but that's
Microsoft. Yeah, and they're still doing some good stuff, but and they're taking a different angle on the market. I'm an advisor to them, and they're trying to build that, you know, they've built a core technology, and they they believe that they can do a lot of stuff because they're independent of the of these individual services, which I think is an interesting angle. But
yeah, but
you know, they need to get need to get more users, right? They, and they're not then moving away from the hardware side of things.
The whole point of the voice thing is not that the technology of recognizing voices and speaking back to you is hard, although it is. It's tying it into this huge back end database of things.
Services, yeah,
right. Yeah, which
the interesting thing with voices, though, I still don't know
you have that and you want and you're trying to sell it to people, you know.
I don't know how voice ever gets super popular on mobile, because I cannot imagine being on the tube or on the New York subway and having everyone talking into their phones.
That's the concern. You know,
it's weird.
I have with it, to be honest with you, that it's not private. I'm not talking about the sense of privacy here, in the sense literally that I'm not going to walk down the street. Now we've grasped the idea that computing technology is pervasive, that you can have it on the street, right, when you're in a bar, when you're on the train. If I switch to talking to my thing, then great. It's great if you're saying, okay, computer, tea, Earl Grey hot or whatever. But I wouldn't want to switch.
I think it's game-changing at home, but I still don't know how it applies to mobile.
I think you'll have both. Like, you'll have your little home thing at home, which is fine. And then, you know, like, if you're in a car, then you'll... Like, I use Google Assistant all the time on my Pixel. But, like, if I'm on a train, then I type it.
Yeah,
but,
I mean, and I think also once we start to have kind of different things of, like, wearables in your ears, you know, with microphones built in, where if you do feel like you're walking down the street, it's not as weird. You know, people already are on the phone when they're walking down the street, so it doesn't become as odd. Maybe being on the train is still... a weird experience, but I think obviously the microphones will also get better about distinguishing between voices and that sort of stuff too. I don't know. I think.
There's a thing in a million science fiction stories where they'll talk about they sub-vocalize, but they seem to be sort of saying a thing that a throat microphone picks up, although no one else can hear it. And I didn't realize for years that this wasn't real. I thought, well, that's the solution to all this voice control stuff, right? And then someone said, yeah, you know, you can't do that, right?
Well, I think this is an interesting topic. I think El Communitar will probably be quite interested in this. Go and let us know what you think. First of all, like, can there be a third player? But also, what do you think is going to be the next big thing in technology? We'll see what happens. There we have it. We have a show. Thank you, Christina, for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
A lot of fun, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And for your movie choices, which are always good. And of course, your, you know, insight on the viable third option. We have to talk about something very important, chaps, don't we?
We do.
Do you want to talk about this, Langridge? You're bombastic and enthusiastic about things that people should do.
Okay, so... those of you who are listening to the show will probably already know about SCALE, Southern California Linux Expo. And you should also know that we, Bad Voltage, are doing a show there. What day are we doing the show on, Jono?
3rd of March. It's going to be Friday the 3rd of March.
Friday the 3rd of March. Yeah. We are doing a live show at SCALE in Pasadena, California, right? Now, you should be going to SCALE anyway because it's amazing. If you weren't going to SCALE before, you should be going because there's a live show being done by us on stage. But there are now a whole bunch more reasons why you should come to our live show, which we announced, I think, like 2 hours ago.
Right, we did.
Much planning has gone on. Jono, describe things.
So last couple of years, we've done shows at SCALE, and they've always been a load of fun. And this year is going to be amped up to a whole new level. So we have good friends at Ticketmaster and at Linode, who are sponsoring this. And basically, a dedicated venue is going to be hired, which is not far, it's like walking distance from the main SCALE venue. Doors open at 6 p.m. There'll be free food, some free booze, and non-alcoholic drinks as well. So everyone can get fueled up. And then at 8 p.m., we're going to be doing a live show, and there's going to be all kinds of cool stuff in that show. We're going to have some fun topics, some games. We're going to have plenty of audience participation. We'll be giving out a ton of prizes. It's going to be a great time.
Yeah.
But you definitely want to get there early, because there is going to be a limited amount of audience room there. The wider venue's got plenty of room, but there'll be limited room for us. So make sure that you get there early so you can get a seat or you can get a space to stand. And then afterwards, we're going to finish the show up about 9 o'clock, and then we're going to have a band called the Spasmatics, which are freaking awesome. They're like an 80s nerdy cover band. They're going to be coming on and playing, and there'll be a dance floor. It's just going to be a great time. So Friday, 3rd of March in Pasadena, California, you got to get along. It's going to be a great time. Bad Vulture Show, Spasmatics, free food and drinks, lots of prizes.
There will be taco trucks. This is our largest attempt so far, I would say. We've done some good live shows, but I anticipate this will be our best.
This should trump the whole lot. So get along, get your scale tickets.
Yeah, and just a couple of things you need to know as well is you have to take your scale badge, right? So if you're a random, if you're not willing to go to scale, then sorry, go away. Scale is, even if you just want to come to this, just go and register a badge, okay? Go and buy it.
We do have a discount code, correct, for available for people?
I think so. I think it's B-Vault.
I think it is B-Vault, yes.
It was last year and the year before, I think, so... But yeah, we want to say a huge thank you to obviously our friends at Scale, who are always amazing for hosting us, but also our friends at Ticketmaster and Linode. So thank you for all of this. It's going to be killer.
Absolutely. So. It's going to be an absolutely amazing show, and I am properly looking forward to it.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was it, really. I guess we'll wrap it up. Anything else we need to say?
No, I think we're good. Thank you. Thank you very much again to Christina for coming along and being the first of our special guests.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Christina, do you have any words of wisdom you want to leave us with? Anything you want to plug?
Yeah. So you can listen if you'd like listening to me on this. I also am on a tech podcast called Rocket. It's called relay.fm/rocket. And it's me and two other women talking about the news and tech. It's accelerated geek conversation. We usually do try to have some sort of pop culture stuff in there too, but it's mostly just kind of tech news. So tune in.
Very cool.
Nice.
Go and check out Rocket.
Go and listen to Rocket. I listen to Rocket, and it's very cool.
We will put a link in the show notes too.
Thank you so much.
We'll definitely put a link in the show notes. All right. Thank you, everyone. See you next time.